the been thinking about McDonald's all day, can't get it off my mind. I can already taste it. Ooh, got my mind on my mouth and my mouth ready for some Mickey D's deal.
There's a deal for every moment at McDonald's.
Right now, get two of your favorites for just $3.50. Mix and match a classic McChicken, a hot and spicy McChicken, or a juicy McDouble. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Fans, welcome to the AFA podcast, the official podcast for animationforadults.com. My name is Rachel, and joining me today is Evan. Hey, Evan.
Hi, Rachel. Hi, guys.
Hey. So we're here. We wanted to actually have a bit more of another casual chat, but we're really, I'm really interested to get into this one because it goes into a bit of nostalgia for both me and for you, Evan.
Yep.
Because we were originally for this podcast, we were originally thinking of doing a talk about a film that is going through, what year anniversary is it? Cause it's 2000. God, my math is awful. 2021. This movie came out in 2001.
It's the 20th anniversary.
Yeah. 20th. Yeah. So yeah. You mentioned about having like your brain being fried. Like you're not
no.
having that going on today.
I'm not laughing at you, Rachel. I'm laughing with you. Cause I had to think for a second too. Yeah. 20 years.
Yeah, it's just like, oh gosh, dang it. When we went over the 2020s, it's just like after that last year, everything just, you felt 5 years into one. So one of the more popular, I think, early films from DreamWorks, the now very prominent DreamWorks Animation Studios, Shrek is having its 20th anniversary this year. So originally, we were hoping to have, you know, get the crew together and talk about, generally like this film and what it meant for DreamWorks going forward, because it really kind of, I mean, DreamWorks had already come out with a couple of other films prior to this, but I think that was their first computer generated feature. Oh no, it was not their first because their Ants came out before that. So it's not, definitely wasn't their first, but a lot of people resonated with Shrek when it was released. So originally we wanted to kind of dissect that how we normally do with a film deep dive. However, interestingly enough, as my research into this film kind of went by through this week, I kind of got pulled into something else, into realizing a lot of people that have been involved in a lot of my favorite childhood productions, going all the way back to, I'm not sure, it was a British studio, Ambulation, which was a animation kind of side studio from that Steven Spielberg kind of created. So The Witch was involved with the likes of American Tail. I think it's not the first one, but its sequel, and a few others. And I was very curious to find out that when Ambulation went under, or when they closed their doors, a lot of those animators transitioned over into DreamWorks. And I just thought that it might be fun to we'll start definitely talking about Shrek and what it meant for DreamWorks, but I really want to kind of give those folks their due, because even if those films were not as popular or did not really satisfy any critics, they still hold a special place in my heart. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels that way. So I kind of want to, we're kind of do a little travel back in time, or back to the future, back in time, kind of, start with Shrek, and we'll see what other movies we want to talk about that really meant a lot to us in those early days. But yeah, so Evan, what's your history with the Shrek film, if I may ask?
Well, Rachel, that's a good question. I mean, when I think of films that I grew up with, Shrek is definitely one of the ones that comes to mind. Like, I saw it when it first came out. I was probably like 7 or 8 at the time. I think at the time it was the most eccentric and probably the crudest animation that I'd seen. My parents took kind of a risk there. They were super conservative, but they were like, this looks interesting, so we'll take a look at it. You know, and it's not like it was, you know, lewd or anything, but, most people who are listening have seen the film, you know, and the vibe's different, you know, it's a little more irreverent. and kind of sophomoric with some of its humor. But yeah, I remember watching it. I actually remember the night. Oddly enough, I remember sitting in my my parents' room, like the family had all gathered together, and we were watching it on our little, you know, I don't know, like 20-inch TV or whatever, with a little VHS, you know.
VHS, those yeah. were the days.
Yeah, I think we were, it was like a rental or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just remember loving it. I think we watched it like 5 times that week. We just couldn't stop laughing. So that's my memory with Shrek.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I unfortunately don't remember the first time I saw it. I know I watched it. I watched it quite a bit after I first saw it. A lot of it was like sleepovers with friends during, because I think it was in, 2021. It had not been too long. It had been a couple of years since I'd moved back from England and was back in the States. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a whole lot of friends at the time, but I was starting to meet people and, you know, and start trying to get my way into friend groups. And, you know, sometimes we would have these sleepover nights where we'd have a movie on in the background. And more often than not, I noticed that it was this movie and I enjoyed it. I can't say, let me put it this way. It's definitely of the Shrek movies, because there was, you know, it was more so popular. So there's definitely more than one. It's not my favorite. Yeah. I did enjoy it for what it was. And the fact that it was just, like you said, it was very irreverent and like it took as many shots as it could at like the Disney tropes and characters and lines and quotes. Like there are so many like references and jokes made at Disney's expense that I thought was really like, it kind of dates the film a little bit, but considering how like at the time there really was no one else competing with Disney in terms of, good quality animation. And of course, Pixar was already starting to roll out their computer generated animation as well with Toy Story and their other films.
Yeah.
But no, yeah. Like, I think that's probably the thing I enjoyed the most about Shrek and continue to do is the fact that it just takes, like you said, it really, and like I said, not in an overly crude way, but it just really kind of makes, like, you know, if you were an adult, like if you really, you know, or your parents sit and your kids watch Disney movies over and over and to the point that you get tired of them, the jokes in this movie will definitely appeal to you, because that's kind of why I think they took the way that they did with that movie is because they wanted it to appeal as many people as, you know, many audiences yep. as possible. So the kids will like the characters and the, you know, and a little bit of their own, like more of the childish humor, but all the references and like smack talk at Disney is going to get the adults laughing for sure. But yeah, so interestingly enough though, it was, let me say that this film had kind of an interesting development. Well, I'm a little light into this because I think, it's just going to be me talking here, but, it originally was not supposed to be computer generated. When Steven Spielberg got the rights to this movie, his original hope was that he would actually, much like some of the other earlier DreamWorks films, actually have this be a 2D production. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, Shrek is such an iconic title, you know, mm-hmm. in the DreamWorks canon. I don't think anyone would be able to picture it as anything other than 3D at this point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe in some other world, it would have been just as awesome. I don't know.
Yeah, I would have been really curious to see what that would have looked like, especially with what we'll get into with the artists and animators who were mm-hmm. in DreamWorks at the time, and the 2D, other 2D films that did come out previously or earlier, like just or roughly around the time that Shrek came out, were, you know, again, not 100% not successful by any stretch, but like I've gone back and looked at some of the animation in some of those movies and I'm like, my jaw hits the floor every time. Like, yeah. Did you ever see the Sinbad movie, the DreamWorks Sinbad movie?
Yep.
Like the animation on that movie is insane.
Yeah,
like
it's a spectacle. It really is.
Oh my God. Like I could like sometimes I've just kind of like backtracked through that movie and look at the scenes where they have the goddess of chaos, Eris, I believe her name is.
Yep.
I don't think I've seen anything like it before or since. It's amazing. I wish I could meet these people and shake their hands, or at least, you know, from a distance nowadays.
No. I mean, like we could go down a whole other rabbit hole with Sinbad. I think it was made like it was a hybridized film, right? Like it was made with a combination of 2D and 3D. I mean,
we've
seen other titles made, you know, around that time, like early 2000s, like Treasure Planet, that kind of had a similar aesthetic. And and when it's done well, it looks great. But again, that's going to take us in another direction. But
that is very true.
I agree with you, Rachel.
We'll stay with Shrek for a little while. Yeah, but right. I'm just trying to picture like how like having that kind of freedom might have changed how Shrek was made, because I think the whole idea is when Spielberg was talked out of doing it in 2D, they were kind of thinking about doing a kind of motion capture CG hybrid with the animation, but they ended up they couldn't go through with that because they did it. And then they got the results back and how people thought it looked, and it just did not look right. It was really, really struggling, and they had to try and find a kind of happy medium, or in terms of just really kind of going back to basics to get this movie to look the way that they wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because I didn't really think, I don't know. It just, I never really knew that. I mean, this is me still kind of getting into the whole fact that I'm going back and learning all these films that I've watched growing up as a kid, their background history. And sometimes I'm like, oh, wow, they really had a hard time with this. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. This is total speculation. But, you know, at the time, right, Rachel, I mean, 3D animation was still kind of a relatively new aesthetic. You know, it was still kind of getting a foothold in the industry. Mm-hmm. If Shrek was made, this makes sense in my mind, maybe it's not going to make sense when I say it, but if Shrek was made to be this kind of parody of Disney, which historically was up to that point, you know, like almost entirely 2D, maybe, you know, DreamWorks wanted to kind of distance itself from that aesthetic in order to like make it clear what it was mocking. I don't know, you know.
That's an interesting point. I like that, actually. The fact that it was just another way of kind of stepping away, saying, oh, we're not Disney. We have our own unique identity. We're DreamWorks. And we're trying to assert that authority that identity by doing things that Disney wouldn't want to do.
Yeah, maybe. Or they just thought it would look better. It's probably the second part, but whatever.
Yeah. I mean, hey, to be fair, then considering what we got, I mean, I don't, I was going back and I was watching Shrek earlier today. And I think like in certain aspects of the animation still hold up for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I don't know if it's just maybe that particular style that they decided to go with doesn't really overly appeal to me or not, because it's good. It's just not the kind of style that I think, you know, that really appeals to me. That's kind of why it's not one of those films that I constantly go back to watch.
Yeah. 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 Well, if you just take it at face value, I wouldn't exactly describe it as beautiful, right? It doesn't have that sort of visual allure that you see in the much more sort of like, you know, romantic Disney fare. You know, maybe that was intentional too. Maybe if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like just looking at it, you know, it may have been a bit of a turnoff. Maybe that was intentional.
Well, but now you're saying that, I think you might be right, because again, it's we're tying back into the Shrek. His character is the whole fact that he's an ogre. He's considered ugly by most people, but there's more to him than just that. Yeah. There's more to him than just that, and that's something that was thought was really. You know what? That ties in really nicely. I think, I'm not sure if that's 100% true, but I'm going to go with it.
All right.
So what was, let's see. I think what else you wanted to do for talking about this movie, because there's not, like I said, unfortunately, as far as this movie goes, it's other than a few of the background details I had, there's not too much to talk about other than the fact that this movie, just like we've mentioned before, just a lot of it can just consists of making fun of the various fairy tale characters, yeah, and showing them in different situations that, again, are less fantastical, more humorous.
Yeah.
Like donkey, like a dragon falling in love with a donkey, like, hi.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there's definitely a lot to unpack there. We can definitely flesh out like the different ways in which this film kind of satirizes Disney or just fairy tales in general. Should we talk about the story? I feel like most people have seen this.
Let's touch on it a little bit.
Yeah. Why not? Cover our bases.
It's 20 years old. This is, you know.
Yeah.
Can almost go out and get a drink.
Yeah.
So yeah, the whole story, if you're not familiar, Shrek is an ogre and he is enjoying his privacy in his little swamp home. And but he's finding that he's got a lot more people coming after him with torches and pitchforks more often than not. And it's something that doesn't really upset him anymore. He just enjoys scaring people. But apparently this lord of a castle or kingdom is trying to make his kingdom absolutely positively perfect, meaning no fairy tale creatures or people or any kind of magic, and he is in the process of rounding them all up and sending them away somewhere, and that place ends up being Shrek's swamp. And so when he comes back, he just has all these different, like, you've got the wolf from Little Red Riding Hood and the grandma's outfit. You've got the three blind mice. You've got Pinocchio, the three little pigs, the bears from Goldilocks. Like, all of them are here. And he's like, okay, I want you to get out of here. Like, well, we can't go unless I'm stumbling over myself now. But he has to go talk to the Lord to get them to all leave.
Yep.
And that one thing leads to another. And so he talks to this Lord Farquaad. Farquaad, I think, is his name. And he's ridiculously short. They make a point to just continuously make fun of his height.
Yeah.
But he wants to be a king and he needs to marry a princess to be a king. And then we get a whole thing of him sending Shrek out on this quest to find him a princess to become a king. And then we have the introduction of Fiona. I'm speeding through this. Do you want me to take my time more or?
No, I think you're covering your bases, Rachel. Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. Fiona, who's been waiting for her Prince Charming to come in this tower being guarded by a lady dragon. And one very funny action sequence later, Fiona is very disappointed to find out that an ogre, not a Prince Charming, has come to save her. And Shrek's like, tough cookies, let's go. But over the course of their journeying back to the kingdom, they begin to develop some romantic feelings toward each other. And apparently Fiona even has a secret that at night she turns into an ogre herself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have a very exciting third act where, you know, the third act fallout where they have a misunderstanding, go their separate ways, and then they realize, oh no, we actually love each other. And then we have the big climax with, it's at the chapel with the whole, you got it, I object to this marriage.
Yeah.
they even make a good joke about that. But yeah. And then they, at the end of the movie, both of them are married to each other and yeah, everyone's the Lord's kicked out he gets eaten by a dragon. He gets eaten by a dragon and then everyone's happy.
Yeah. Yeah, in that Shrek,
right? Yeah, I'm sorry. That was like real Reader's Digest version of the whole film. So, but yeah, it's a fun movie. I'm not gonna lie. It's fun. Again, not my favorite of the Shrek movies, but I can see why it got a lot of people on board for future movies.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely, Rachel. I don't know. We were talking about how the film makes fun of Disney and fairy tales, and you kind of see those little jokes, you know, like peppered throughout the story.
Yeah, like what are ones that stood out to you the most? in the film?
Well,
or the most tasteful, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the part that stood out the most, I think, I absolutely love Sleeping Beauty. It is like one of my favorite films of all time. Uh-huh. And I distinctly remember Shrek, like that scene in Shrek where they absolutely like rip on Sleeping Beauty, because Fiona's like in the forest or whatever singing, and this little bird like lands on, you know what I'm talking about, Rachel.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
This little bird lands on a branch next to Fiona, and Fiona starts singing louder, and the bird tries to join in and starts singing louder. Fiona sings even louder. The bird sings even louder and eventually explodes. Just it's just like this macabre, completely out of the blue, like moment of dark comedy where it like literally sung its heart out. And that was like definitely a rip on Sleeping Beauty right there, because I distinctly remember her, you know, like dancing around, you know, Tchaikovsky and being joined in song by all the little woodland creatures. And
Princesses and woodland creatures, Disney princesses and woodland creatures. Get along, but apparently not this one.
Not in this story.
This one makes birds explode.
Yeah. How about you, Rachel?
What? Oh God. There are way many. I think mine is also tied to a Fiona joke. Where she's in the tower, and when Shrek's first coming in, and she's clearly awake, and yet she's like, "Okay, I gotta get in the position," and he lies on the bed. Her hands are across her chest and she's lying down. He comes in, he comes up to the bed, and she's like, she starts puckering her lips for a kiss, and he just shakes her awake. And she's like, wait, what? That was the one that I think stood out to me the most. The others are just kind of like, are really kind of just like rapid fire with like, when we get introduced to Eddie Murphy's character, Donkey, there's like, two or three like right in succession. There's there's the he can fly from when Tinkerbell gets pixie dust all over Donkey, starts flying, and they start doing the he can fly kind of thing. And then they even make a Dumbo reference literally in the, like the same scene, and I'm just like, my God.
Disney references are
everywhere.
It's really relentless. I mean, like, that's probably what makes this film so impressive, just that, I guess, the deafness with which they just continually insult this, like, time-worn idea of knights in shining armor and princesses. But at the end of the day, that's also what makes this not comical, but also really meaningful, right? I mean, this, I'm stating the obvious. I mean, I feel like people, when they watch this, like, definitely get this from the film, but it really kind of you know, takes this very, you know, fixed idea of what beauty should look like, what courtship should look like, what love should look like, and just completely flips it on its head and shows you something that's much more in touch with reality, right? You know,
I mean,
Shrek and Fiona aren't outwardly beautiful, but the love that they share inwardly is very beautiful, you know?
And
you have all those little personality foibles and stuff, you know, that each of them possess, some of which aren't particularly attractive at all. Like Shrek farts a lot and, you know, likes to drink, you know, like there's this big laundry list of things that are gross and disgusting about him, but Fiona loves him anyway, you know? And I think that's something that we can all, you know, learn from and relate to.
Yeah. I think that's the heart and soul of the movie for sure. The whole ogres are like onions. They have layers.
Yeah. Yes.
there's more to them than just just what you see.
Yeah. 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 If you were to like sum up, if you were to take a line from the film that you think like best encapsulated the theme, it would be that right there, right? I think you've hit the nail on that, Rachel. Ogres have layers, right?
Ogres have layers. They're just like onions.
It's a good film.
Absolutely. And again, much like ogres having layers, when I was going into researching this this film and realizing that its production had many layers to it, it's the studio itself and how it was kind of trying to make an identity for itself was also multi-layered, and kind of tying into, you know, our little backtracking through some of the other productions that they were working on at the time, because they had quite a few films that had already come out. And we talked, I mentioned Ants before. That was actually their very first ever film that came out. It was also the first CG film that they did. I remember enjoying that film, but I never, it never really kind of stuck out to me. Like in terms of, I remember being at certain parts of it being pretty grisly, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Cause I mean, you had that film and then you also had Bug's Life, I think was coming out just right around the same time. So you had two movies about ants.
Yeah. Obviously.
Two very different movies.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, totally. I'll be honest. I shamefully haven't seen Ants, but I do know that it skews much more adult than Bug's Life does. Were they released right around the same time?
Let me double check that. I'm pretty sure. Well, I'm pretty sure they were.
I don't know if like Ants could possibly seen as a stab at Bug's Life. I'm probably wrong and have my chronology mixed up, but we're talking about Shrek, you know, kind of mocking Disney. But I mean, regardless, I've heard it's a hilarious film. You know, I don't want to, you know, give out any negativity or anything. It's just interesting that they're so similar.
Yeah, because Ants that came out in that was September 19th. 1998.
Okay.
Bug's Life. Let me just go ahead and pull that up here. This is interesting.
I got to know Bug's Life, man. 98. Yeah. There you go.
They were in fact the same year.
Yeah.
Holy moly! I thought they were maybe like half a year apart, but
yeah. So that was just like pure coincidence then. Like, there's no way that Ants could have been an answer to Bug's Life or anything.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. There was only like, now that I'm looking at this, there's only like 2 months between them.
Wow. Great minds think alike, I guess.
I guess so.
I mean, like both studios just thought, hey, we're going to make a show about bugs. I mean, a movie about bugs. Yeah.
We're going to make two movies, very different movies about bugs. That's a little little chestnut for you. Wow.
Yeah.
You learn something new every day.
You do.
But let me see what other film, and we kind of were referring to some of the other ones. Because that came out, like a lot of these films were coming out exactly. They were timing these. I think they wanted to try and make like 9 a year, I think is what was their original goal was. Wow. And I mean like high, that's a lot.
Yeah. Very
because ambitious. Because Ants came out in 1998 on early in the fall, and then right on its heels, right around Christmas time, is The Prince of Egypt, which in my opinion needs no introduction.
Yeah. That is one of the, I'm not even gonna say one of the greatest animated films of all time. I sincerely believe like it is one of the greatest films of all time. Like,
I'm right there with you. That is, cannot count the number of times I've rewatched that movie.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, really kind of cool to see, like, the word, you know, the, going from, and here's my question to you, because we had, you know, talking about, I think off the air, we were talking about some of the potential, like, history that some of these, you know, these artists and animators might have had, especially when they were connected to Don Bluth. Do you see any of that like visual or style similarity from like say some like we were talking about the other Don Bluth movies in terms of how his guys look relatively the same? You don't see any of that in going forward with Prince of Egypt or Road to El Dorado, because I think in terms of how they animated or stylized the human characters, they're pretty similar.
Yeah, a little bit. It's definitely not something I've noticed quite as much, but go on. Yeah,
well, I think it's like the idea is that you could see like if you have like look at the characters from Prince of Egypt and you look at the characters from Road to El Dorado or even like Sinbad, like you can imagine those characters, even though they're not tied together necessarily, they look like they could inhabit the same world, I guess.
Yeah, 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 I agree with you, Rachel. Now that I think about it, the aesthetic at the very least, and probably the character design, I honestly don't have as keen an eye for that as you do, because I don't draw. it's quite similar. Yeah.
Yeah.
But in a good way.
Yeah, I think, gosh, if I'm thinking about Prince of Egypt, like the music and the music is definitely the thing that blows me away every single time I watch it. And the music, it is obviously, you know, your Disney musicals, you know, they've been done to death at that point. But the music in this was just very, due to its, you know, the story's spiritual ties, like it just continuously knocked the ball out of the park. And I'm pretty sure the person who was involved in that music production, I think they were also like, they created Wicked, or part of the creation of the musical, the Broadway musical Wicked.
I'll believe it. Yeah. I mean, we could have an entire episode about this film, but just the production value in general beyond the music is amazing, you know, and that's what makes a great film, right? Is when you just go all out, you know, visually and sonically. The score is amazing. The acting is amazing. They had some great names on there, like Ralph Fiennes and, you know, Val Kilmer, you know, these big A-list, you know, Hollywood stars, Sandra Bullock, you know,
Goldblum is in there.
Yeah. 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 I mean, like, I'm sure I missed some people, but the list goes on. You know, you tie that all in with great music and, you know, just an amazing, you know, like rich story world. And, it really is an unforgettable film. Yeah.
Yeah. I have an interesting history with this film because of the fact that, you know, I was born, you know, I was raised Christian. So I was familiar with the story of Moses. And obviously this is not the first time someone tried to tackle that story in film. But of all the, I've seen, gosh, what was the name of the other movie? Ten Commandments, I think is what it was called.
With Heston, way back.
Yeah, with Heston. Yeah. Well, there were some cool elements to that movie. I think I don't know if it was because it was animated or not. I feel like the story and how it was portrayed in The Prince of Egypt, I got a stronger resonation of like where the heart of that story was.
Yeah.
Especially where the tragedy came from, the fact that you had two guys who were raised as brothers, falling apart basically, and not sugarcoating it.
I
love that, because I mean in the Ten Commandments, gosh, why is the character's name Ramses and Moses, you know, they're kind of already antagonistic toward each other, or they're not really, I don't remember. Yeah. I remember finding Ramses in the Ten Commandments not as, I didn't have as much sympathy for him as I did for the Ramses and Prince of Egypt. Oh my gosh. That character arc is brutal.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But that's how you write a good villain. You know, you humanize them, and you've already said it, Rachel, but that is one of the many things that makes this story so compelling. That is, it is so intensely human. You know, you know that Moses is in the right, of course, but you sympathize with Ramses, and you can feel the heartbreak as they're, you know, relationship starts to deteriorate. But yeah, I completely agree. You know, as epic and amazing and historically significant as, you know, Heston's The Ten Commandments was, there's definitely an element of separation there between Moses and Ramses that you do not see in The Prince of Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one of
dramatic.
It's more dramatic, and it gives the film its identity. Like if you want to see a more like traditional telling of that story, then you go to the Ten Commandments. If you want to see something that's really dramatic, really emotional, really beautiful, has beautiful music, then you go to The Prince of Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's really something there for everyone. I mean, I know you and I said we were both raised Christian, and you know, I think it's very tempting for some people to see this as an exclusively Christian story, but that's not really true. You know,
no.
I mean, the story of Moses is as much Christian as it is, you know, Islamic or Jewish.
Jewish for sure.
Even if you're secular or practice another faith, there's still something for you here, because like you said, the story arc is so compelling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I say this with respect. By no means do I consider myself like a biblical expert or an expert in religion, but the point I'm trying to make is that I really think that DreamWorks did something special there by taking this story that's so intensely, you know, wrapped up into multiple faiths and you know, sharing it with the world and making it appealing to just about everybody.
Would you agree with that, Rachel?
I don't know. That's kind of the vibe I got watching
it. No, I think what it what was able to do is because, you know, this is a story that is, like you said, it's part of many different religions. I think what they were able to do in a way they didn't isolate it to one religion. They said, this is just a really powerful story. And they sold us on that powerful story by giving it the chutzpah or the energy it needed to really just kind of to resonate with people like it already does, because it's, you know, whether you're reading it, watching film, it's still powerful narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even though there isn't a lot of dogma or anything in this, they do not diminish the spirituality either, or the spiritual power of the film. I mean, the sequence when, you know, like Moses meets God in the burning bush.
Right. Oh my God. That's one of my favorite scenes.
No. Yeah. I mean, like, I forget who voiced God. Was it also Val Kilmer? I think it was.
It was the voice. Here's a really cool stylistic choice. I'm not sure if you or anyone else picked up on this, but I did. Actually, not, like a while ago, back when I was rewatching it, it is when God speaks to Moses, he speaks to Moses in his voice.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an amazing choice.
There's probably all sorts of, you could analyze that in so many different ways.
I know.
But, he speaks, the voice of God, I'll just leave it at that.
Voice of God.
Which with such love, but also omnipotence. It just commands respect, but it envelops you in its warmth. And you just feel, I know we're talking about a film, but I mean, it's so convincing that you really kind of feel the presence of God, you know, in that voice.
He knocked that scene out of the park when he recorded that. That was, it's like, again, because there's the two sides, at least, you know, like the more, like you said, the compassionate, but also a little bit of the fire and brimstone God, because he is sending these terrible plagues to, you know, Egypt when he's not letting the Jews, you know, the Jews go. And it's just, and you see it, man, they go all in. You see these frogs, animals dying, locusts, you know, all oh, give me the chills.
We're going to be stuck on Prince of Egypt forever.
I know. But well, maybe we might do a deep dive on that later on sometime. Yeah. Hey, if our listeners out there want to request us to do a full-on deep dive of that film, you know, just send us an email or send us a message on social media, and we will definitely move that up on the list.
I know earlier, Rachel, I'm not sure if this is an appropriate segue. You were talking about tracing DreamWorks back to Amblimation.
Yes.
Simon Wells, who was previously with Amblimation, directed The Prince of Egypt. So maybe he's going to be our gateway into that realm.
That sounds like a great idea. Yeah. And there were three directors overall, but yeah, he was involved for sure. And and he was, oh my gosh, he was basically a director for most of the Amblimation films, I think.
There we go.
All of them. And then he would also continue to go on and do additional work into DreamWorks. He was a story artist, mainly as a story guy.
Wow.
But for like all these different DreamWorks productions, like he was involved in, you know, Spirit, Sign of the Cimarron, Sinbad, Madagascar, Shrek, the Third, Flushed Away, The Croods, Kung Fu Panda 3. In terms of the anime
career,
he did a lot. He did a heck of a lot. That is actually a very good segue, Evan. Thank you for that.
No problem.
Amblimation, it was a very short, unfortunately, very short-lived animation studio, because it only was able to get three films made before they unfortunately had to close their doors. And those films are the sequel to the original American Tale, which is a Don Bluth film, American Tale, Fievel Goes West.
Yep.
Then 1993, we had We're Back, A Dinosaur Story. And then followed that on 1995 with Balto. Which of those films are you the most familiar with?
Definitely Balto. I did see Fievel Goes West several times as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Need to revisit it. It's been a second, but I remember it. It was adorable.
Yeah, it was very different flavor than the original, obviously, because the original had its silly moments, but you know, or it's more humorous moments, but it was definitely a Don Bluth tour de force in terms of the fact that we are going to have fun with this kid's movie, but we're also going to scare the crap out of you.
Yes.
With those demon cats and all that stuff. But no, Fievel Goes West was definitely a more humorous romp, but still, I love the animation in that still, you know, to this day. And my family still has very fond feelings for it because there are just some jokes that are made in that movie that stick with us to this day. This has stuck with my family to this day.
Yeah.
Balto is the one that you're more from. That was, I need to rewatch that movie because there's parts of that movie that I really dig, even though it's not necessarily an accurate portrayal of the historical event that they are talking about. It is still a fun adventure movie for sure.
Yeah. 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 If you wanted to talk about that, you might have to brief me on the history a little more, Rachel, because I know that it was like loosely based on an actual Alaskan snow dog, right? Delivered medicine to a remote village.
Yeah, so that was an actual life event. And there is even, Disney Plus, I think, has a movie that is actually focused about the actual dog who did not have that name. Mm. It was a, accuracy. He was a purebred Siberian Husky, black and white. I'm kind of going through my thing here. Yeah. The sled run to retrieve the medicine was actually a relay. Instead of being the leader of the first and only team, Balto was scheduled to be part. So yeah, it was a relay to get to, to get the medicine. It wasn't a one-way trip, but it was like a team, various teams of sled dogs were kind of making the relay to go get the medicine and then bring it back.
I see.
To the town. I'm trying to remember if the dog's name was actually had that name or have a different name. I'm blanking.
It was Balto. I'm not gonna lie, I had to check, but yeah, the dog's actual name was Balto, yeah, but it was based on or centered, I guess, around an outbreak of diphtheria.
Yeah, diphtheria.
In the Alaskan village of Nome. And Balto, in the film, Balto and his team in real life had to deliver the serums to the village.
To save the kids.
Kind of situated remotely in the wilderness. So that was the only way to get it there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but obviously the film again takes a very like more of it takes that story and definitely amps up the drama, especially when it comes to Balto's character in general, because instead of being a husky, he's a wolf, half husky.
Yeah.
A mixed breed or mutt, if you will. And the town of Nome doesn't look kindly on that. He's kind of like a stray outcast, poor guy.
Yeah.
Raised by a goose. What is with our main characters being raised by geese?
I don't know. The sidekicks in this film are interesting. You made a great point about the kind of like half wolf, half dog identity there, Rachel. Balto definitely has something to prove, right? Nobody really seems to care for him. He makes a couple of friends. There's I think Jenna.
Jenna,
he befriends his love interest.
Yeah.
And then of course, the less jaded children who befriend him. But otherwise, the town doesn't look kindly on Balto. So delivering the vaccine is kind of a rite of passage for him. I guess that is that the right term?
He has to. I think I would call it that. Yeah. Yeah. That's the word I'd use, because it's very like, you know, it's like, oh, he it was his way of proving his worth. But the fun thing I like about that is that he only got there because he finally, because you see a constant struggle of him coming to accept all the parts of himself, especially the part that always been looked down by others. And he only is able to succeed because he acknowledges who he really is and what makes him who he is. And then he's able to lead the team to succeed.
Yeah. 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 And there's a great message there, right? You know, I mean, at the end of the day, Balto was embraced because, not because he's suddenly this dog that saved the town, but because he's a dog wolf, you know, that's saved the town, you know. He learns to love himself and the town learns to love him, you know, after he braves the wilderness and, you know, proves his bravery. I'm thinking about that, that kind of like moment of self-acceptance, of realization.
That's a beautiful scene.
He loses his way in the snow, and this, I forget if it's a physical wolf or an apparition of some like wolf spirit that appears to him and kind of guides him along.
Yeah. It's not made clear, about what that, if that wolf was real or not, but no, it's one of my favorite sequences in the film, is like he kept coming across that white wolf, and it just, it's a really interesting how that scene is animated too, because obviously you have Balto and this wolf, which are used stunning 2D animation. That wolf looks absolutely gorgeous, but then the snow effects that are kind of, you know, this, it looks like a really like a strong like blizzard like snow. I wonder if that's computer generated, because it looks pretty computer generated.
You're asking the wrong guy. I don't know. I'm sure
I have a strong suspicion it is. I have a strong suspicion it is, because I think, like, when, again, trying not to go down that rabbit hole, like you mentioned earlier, but like you said, there was a lot of different, like, interesting combinations of being experimented about not having the 2D production, but also having 3D elements to kind of really sell on certain scenes. Like, gosh, if we're talking about, you know, from the films we discussed already, Prince of Egypt had quite a few with, some of the Egyptian, like, you know, backgrounds, or like the like big really big effects, like the parting of the Red Sea and stuff like that. And then what else we have? And in this we might have, you know, the snow effect. And I know there was one for 50 Goes West, but I can't think of it right now. It's again, it's one of those things like, oh, I haven't seen that film in so long. Like, I watched it so many times. It's like, it's just on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah. It's escaping me too, Rachel. I think I vaguely know what you're talking about, but I mean, I have no doubt it's there, right? I mean, these all came around roughly around the same time, right? Kind of like that mid 90s to early 2000s era, where you saw people starting to experiment with 3D, but maybe not quite fully integrate it, you know, into their films. I miss that, honestly. I don't want to go on a rant, but you know, we've talked about different films that have done this, you know, like Prince of Egypt, like Balto, like, I don't know, Treasure Planet, you know. That's been on the periphery of our discussion, but when it's done right, it looks amazing. When you have both of those styles coming together. So I'll stop myself there, because I think we talked about this last December.
Yeah. Like, that literally, like we've said, that literally could be a topic in and of itself. And I think that needs to be saved for another time. But I was thinking about another scene. I think the scene that I was going to bring up, it was the other Ambulation film, the Dinosaur Story movie. There were quite a few sequences in terms of where the background was CG. There's a sequence, I'm not sure if you ever saw that movie at all growing up. No,
I've heard of it though.
To be fair, it is out of all of the Ambulation movies, it is by far the strangest.
Really?
Oh yes. So
you tell.
Yeah, this movie's let me see if I could try to find a way to summarize it for you, because it's based off a children's book where these dinosaurs are basically taken by this alien and are given more or less sentience to basically say, and the book kind of goes into like, oh, this alien made dinosaurs sentient, sends them into modern day New York where they're part of the Macy's Day Parade. And then they get taken in by this natural museum person who basically has them live in the museum as like a way to entertain kids who come. It's like, oh, look, we have actual dinosaurs. Check this out. But no, part of the thing why this film was made at all, I think, was the fact that it was Jurassic Park was just coming out and it was dinosaur mania at the time when these films were coming out. So, you know, kids, dinosaurs were like the coolest things ever. And in my opinion, they still are. And I only say that because when you play Dungeons and Dragons and you have the ability to basically have your character morph into a dinosaur, I'm like, yeah, I'll do that. I think that's like my inner child is just like jumping up and down. But no, yeah, like this, here's the thing. That story does not make a three-act movie. And you can definitely see when you do watch that movie, you definitely see the struggle that the filmmakers must have had trying to make it a three-act structure. And they really go into some pretty out there areas. Like there's this whole sequence with a fright circus where where the dinosaurs kind of get captured and get their sentience removed and turn back into their old like animalistic selves. And these the audience surrogate characters, the children that are like the semi-main characters, like, oh no, we have to save them kind of thing. And it's like that came out of nowhere. That was just the filmmakers just coming up with that. And just like, it's one of those moments where you're just like, either you have some really creative people or someone's doing some drugs in there, because this is really strange.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit of both. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I'm sure that a lot of people who are listening have seen it. And could probably say more. That just hearing you describe it though, it sounds like kind of a trip.
It is.
Resurrecting dinosaurs and putting them in modern day Manhattan. I gotta chew on that for a second. But
yeah, no, absolutely. So yeah, and I will say that this for me, like, I know it's not like it's not a good film, not a great, you know, it's not even, a lot of it is just subjective for me, because I'm just like, I wore out that VHS tape so many times I watched that movie. I don't know what kept drawing me back. I'm not sure if it was just having these, I don't know if it was the characters, I don't know if it was the animation, or just these out there ideas that just seemed so surreal that just, but still somehow had me emotionally invested as a small child that kept me coming back. And even now, like, say I'll, if it's on TV or something, or if I like see a clip of it on YouTube or something, like, I kind of look at it and was like, that was good times.
Yeah.
That was good times. Yeah. I still appreciate it for what it did, especially because I realized when I went back and I looked at some of the sequences, especially where the dinosaurs are animated a bit more, not necessarily realistically, but they have a really, more of a feral design. I look at that, I'm like, that looks distinctly like the sharp tooth from Land Before Time. So I'm like, did we have some Land Before Time vets involved with this movie? I mean, dinosaurs involved, that would make sense, but still, yeah. Like, so it's probably one of the part of the reason why the studio didn't last too long. But hey, I just want to say that I know the film has some fans with people, and I want to acknowledge that, hey, there was actually some pretty dang good animation in that movie, regardless of how crazy the plot was.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like a novelty film almost, you know, just kind of based on the way you described it. And there's an audience for that, right? I mean, especially, I think, are just like drawn to things that are weird, you know, because they're just less inhibited, you know? I mean, oh, that looks interesting. No one's told me otherwise, so I'll check it out. Yeah. So would you consider this a favorite then for you if you watched it so many times? Is this in Rachel's top 20, top 10?
I would not put it in my, like, in terms of what I think is a really great, amazing film. It's definitely not on that list. This is on top tier. What, number one, top tier, Rachel's guilty pleasure list.
I gotcha. One that, like, you don't openly share with everybody.
Yeah. Like, I have to be careful in terms of who I share it with, because you never know. Like, I mean, I'm sure you have had that moments, like, where you're talking about something that, you know, you get on a topic of conversation with something that you love, but then the person's like, oh no, that movie was crap. This is, and, you know, that, and then you're just kind of silent, like awkwardly sitting there like, I actually still kind of really like it.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how much of that is my nostalgia rose tinted glasses, but it's just, yeah, it's a guilty pleasure for sure. Like, it's like the animated Transformers movie was for me. Again, not necessarily a good movie, but I love it still. Like, I still, like, I'll go back and I'll put it on, like, every now and again. I'm I'm still getting those same feels. The movie's still hitting the same place as it did when I was younger. So I'm like, that's impressive. It hasn't aged with time, you know, it hasn't aged with me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Films that you're making an interesting point here, Rachel. I think films that we encounter as children just, like, naturally have a foothold, you know, in our lives, and that never really, like, quite changes. I think about some of the films that I grew up with too, and not all of them were that good, but I still find myself coming back to them. And I think, like you said, it's just kind of the nostalgia, I guess, the memory attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps bringing you back. So yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of like Pavlov's dog. Like, basically, like, okay, you're putting the same images and stuff that you watched when you were a kid, and you remember the, like, those images giving you very strong emotions. And then it's almost like you have those, like, you put that on, you get some of it comes back, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like almost an instinctual reaction at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But I just thought it was really kind of interesting how those films that, again, while they may not have been, they may not have performed so great in the box office, that they still, I still want to make sure to say, like, they still resonate with a lot of people. And I like to think, and I'm really happy to know that even though the studio didn't do well, that all those animators continue to create and continue to make things that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
And I will still enjoy it, you know, even now as an adult, like we were talking about Simon Wells. He was involved in Kung Fu Panda 3.
Yeah.
Hello. That's phenomenal. Like, I'm so glad that he's still actively involved.
Yeah. Well, beyond Simon Wells, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that all, like, 250 employees, like, who lost their jobs when Amblimation went under ended up at DreamWorks. Yep. I could be wrong about that. Yeah, that's really just amazing, to be honest. They got their happy ending, you know. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always work out like that. You know, even today, you know, we see people that are having that issue. Like, I'm sure that most of our listeners know that Blue Sky closed recently.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where all those people have ended up, you know. I'm sure that they'll find their place somewhere, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes a lot of talent to be attached to a brand like that, but yeah. Amblimation, good for them.
yeah
I went on a tangent there, sorry.
No, that's okay. Well, I think you're right, that is relevant, makes this conversation relevant when talking about Blue Sky. I mean, obviously, you know, the future may be uncertain, but at the very least, we know, like, I hope that, you know, if speaking as someone who enjoyed their films, like, they don't, even if a film doesn't succeed, I think it's important to still acknowledge the work that went into it. Yeah. Even if it did have, you know, things that worked against it, that made it not as, you know, that didn't help, that didn't, it didn't find an audience that at the, a large audience that it resonated with, but there is still something to be said for those, you know, like you said, those little niches, for those people who will kind of go back to those movies. I'm like, you know what? This was good. I liked this a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because those people, I think, at least I know I do, or at least I feel this way whenever I look at something that you know, I love, but it is not necessarily a good film. It's just like, you know what? I still, people put a lot of out, you know, work, sweat and tears into making this production. So I want to appreciate it as much as possible.
Yeah. And that's a healthy attitude to have, you know. I'm sure that any living producer, director would disagree with me on a superficial level, but at the end of the day, if art touches so much as one person, it has value, right?
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the artists who have moved from Ambulation to DreamWorks, you know, I would definitely say that that is exactly the case. And they have continued to do that at least throughout my life. And I'm very super, super thankful for that, because it's helped inspire me to pursue goals that I thought for the longest time were out of my reach.
Yeah. Enough said. That's yep. Awesome.
Well, unless you have anything to add, I think we've kind of exhausted this topic. Again, if any of our listeners want us to do a deep dive at any one of the films that we've talked about today on this episode, by all means, check out our various social media platforms and send us a message and say, hey, love to hear you talk about Prince of Egypt, do a deep dive on Prince of Egypt, or Ants, or 5-0 Goes West, or Balto, like, you know, any one of those movies, please let us know. And we will definitely add that to our recording schedule for this year. We're still I'm still working out our future scheduling, and we still have quite a few dates and slots open. So definitely open to some suggestions from our audience if we have if you guys have any particular films in mind that you'd like us to cover. But yeah, that should be all for us. Evan, mm-hmm. Where can we find you on social media?
Oh, I'm kind of a ghost. I've got Facebook and LinkedIn, which makes me an old man, I guess. But
no, I say hey. If you're on LinkedIn, it's because it's like, okay, I want to make sure I still have a job.
I want to make sure I can get a job. I'm in grad school and need to get a job.
That's always important. That's always important, especially right now. That's incredibly important. Yeah. I am also a bit of a ghost, but I am on Instagram at Fail2Ninja, where I've been, if I'm not posting pictures of my cat, I'm posting pictures of my developing art skills and my animation test. So you're welcome to take a look at those if you like. But yeah, everyone, hope you have a lovely rest of your day, whatever you're doing while you're listening to this podcast. And we will catch you next time on the next episode. See ya.
Yep.
When someone first comes in and you see that discouragement on their face, they've tried so many different products, but nothing seemed to work for them, I'm able to take that disappointment and that pain and turn it into hope.
You're listening to Mallory, an art support specialist at the Goodfeet store.
And they try the art supports. It's a light up moment. You see their face brighten up. They go from feeling discouraged to being happy and hopeful again.
For over 25 years, the Goodfeet store and our art support specialist have been helping folks live the life they love without foot, knee, hip, or back pain getting in the way.
That's why this job is so important. You're helping people, getting back into the activities that they've wanted to do for a long time, doing the things that they love to do with their Goodfeet Art Supports. We're able to help them and take them from the pain to the possibilities. And I love it.
The Goodfeet store is located in Fairfax, Leesburg, Rockville, Baltimore and Hunt Valley, and in Annapolis in the Annapolis Harbor Center. For more information, go to goodfeet.com.